Welcome back once again to Arts Alive. It's the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst coming to you from St. Pete Athletic, where they have a delightful podcast recording studio. I get to watch the pickleball players through the window here. No one out there today, but it's the middle of the day. My name is Bill DeYoung. Did I say that already? Anyway, my guest today is Peter Tosh. He is curator and senior interpreter at the Dalí Museum. You have been at the Dalí for almost 40 years now. Is that?
Oh no,
I really started him off with a gasser right
there. Is that right? That's yeah. I was hired at the end of the 80s. I was still a student working in the store, so that's probably correct.
So you were just working in the gift shop?
Yeah, I was finishing my thesis. I was down a student at New College. So I was living at home. A docent class opened up. I took it, you know, just to keep myself distracted, and a position opened up in the store.
40 years later.
Yes, yes. I've done things. And I lived like that dream opportunity where you can actually grow in the institution, which is pretty much unheard of now. I am very, very thankful.
Those are the days. It used to happen in journalism all the time, too. I'm not so sure it does anymore either.
Yeah.
You know, I came up in the 80s in my profession as well. Where was that, Bill? I was there.
Yes.
It opened in 82. The warehouse, a marine warehouse or
marine
something?
Warehouse, that's right.
Where was it?
It was on 3rd Street South and 11th Avenue, so across from the bus station, I think, at that time when it first opened. And it was, we just had a speaker, Jim Martin, who's a lawyer who was actually responsible for bringing the Dalí here to St. Pete. And he was talking about that whole history. And originally, they tried to convince the Morrisons that the pier would have been the perfect place for it.
Wow.
And they came down, and immediately driving out to the pier, Reynolds Moore said, "This is in the middle of the water. This is a bit of a, you know, this isn't going to work." And so the St. Pete had just acquired that space of the old marine warehouse that became the building.
Was it always an intention that it'll move out of here someday if it does well, or did that just come later?
Yeah, that actually came later. I think it was clearly within that first decade that they realized, you know, whenever Andrew hit Miami, the board became obviously extremely concerned. It just took that much longer for the money to be raised for an opportunity to move it to a safer space.
This would have been the old inverted pyramid pier.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, yes. I can't even imagine how that would have gone. Tell us about the Morrises and their relationship with Salvador Dalí, because it really kind of will imbue everything we're going to talk about today.
Right.
Can you talk about them?
Yeah, they were a young couple living in Cleveland. They got married in 1942. She was born into the Cleveland Reese Chemical Company, and he was from Denver, a silver mining family. And so they met. He had been in Harvard Business School. They got married, and right before they got married, there was a traveling exhibition of Dalí's work, and they actually got to see it at the Cleveland Museum. So sort of part of their moving towards getting married was having this incredible passion that they shared for this young Spaniard. And the following year for their anniversary gift, they bought a painting that I believe they saw in that show. They actually bought it over the phone, which amazes all of us. You know, they did not go to look at it. And they found out from the dealer that that the Dalís were actually in New York. Ah. So within a month, they met the artist and his wife. They got on like gangbusters. They purchased a number of other smaller works, and it became this 3 decades of just interacting, sharing, traveling, buying.
Now, Dalí only came to the States, in the early 30s, I think. So,
yeah.
So did he have a lot of American patrons, a lot of American friends?
He definitely had the right friends. It was like Caress Crosby, who was a very wealthy socialite. She befriended Dalí and Gala when they were in Spain, in Paris. Mm-hmm. They became great friends. Julian Levy, who was just starting out and having a gallery in Madison Avenue, he got really excited by Dalí and thought there was a market for Dalí in America. And through their kind of overtures, he came here in 1934. And he came right at the right time. The Great Depression was sort of still on everybody's mind. And here is this person who's larger than life, completely seeming like a brand item, you know, like constantly thinking about how to promote himself. And he was zany and crazy and a great painter. And it just like checked all the right boxes for Americans.
Well, you know, I had written down here, what did America do for Dolly? And then I wrote under it, what did Dolly do for America?
Yeah.
And I think you just answered that.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like when the Beatles emerged after the Kennedy assassination at the right time.
Yeah.
For something to, you know, change maybe the national mood. He became a celebrity in America.
He did.
Which he was for all the rest of his days.
Yeah. I don't think he could have become a celebrity if he had stayed in Europe. I think the whole concept of celebrity was an American invention, you know, and it's like our magazines, our advertising,
yeah.
Just the whole process of using the media, using movies. He just embraced all of it. And no other artist had up until that point.
And continued to change and create and you know, be weird in a delightful way, and took surrealism in all kinds of directions, even after its heyday in like the 20s and maybe 30s.
Right.
Amazing stuff. So the Morses, why did Dolly just like them because they had money and they paid him, or were they actually friendly?
Well, they were definitely friendly. I think what really appealed to Dolly about the Morses is they were young, because all of his collectors were older than him at that point. They did have money, and they were so enthusiastic. I mean, they were perfect Americans. They wanted to know everything. They wanted to know the stories. They wanted to ask all the questions. Europeans were more blasé, I guess might be the right word for it. And so I think Dolly just realized he had stumbled upon his future, you know.
So that's what America did for Dolly. The Morses amassed a pretty great collection of stuff.
Yes.
And can you recap very, very briefly how their collection ended up here? It was some kind of national bidding war or something. I don't know what their connection with St. Petersburg was. I don't remember this.
There was no connection.
None. Oh, well, okay. I mean, that's why I don't remember.
That is the fascinating part. So, you know, a local attorney, James Martin, he had been in business for a little bit, about 6 years, read the Wall Street Journal about this plight that the Morses had, because they knew they needed to move their collection and give it to somebody.
Out of Cleveland. Right.
Apparently, they had it for about 10 years as a private museum. They were about to sell their business, to move it to California. And I guess the collection had been part of their business. It's like this is the way they did a workaround with the U.S. government and taxes. But they knew they needed to give it as a gift intact. A lot of museums didn't want the responsibility for having a full Dolly collection. Like the Cleveland Museum wanted to cherry pick a few, and the Morses wanted it to be left intact. And
oh, so, sure. All or nothing.
Yeah. And so they only had a few places. Like Austin, Texas was interested. There was a place in Denver that was interested. But, you know, it's like, so this article was focusing on the difficulty. And this gentleman, you know, James Martin, not just starting out, but he knew some people in the city, and he said, wouldn't it be great to have a Dolly collection here in St. Pete because of the vacant pier floor? The third floor of the pier was open at that point. He thought that would work. You know, and the thing that I don't understand is that when he told others, they said, that's a great idea. Let's do it. And within a week, they called the Morses, and they visited, and it's like it happened within like a 2-year period.
So I guess cha-cha coconuts wasn't raking in the big bucks in those days. I was living in Gainesville in those days and coming with my kids to visit their grandparents, and that pier, I don't know, that pier always seemed a little shabby to me. I'm sorry. You know, no offense, Mr. Harvard, you know, but not at all. This is what I find so fascinating. We're going to pick up this narrative in a second, but I think it's Visit St. Pete Clearwater that says that the Dolly Museum is the number one visitor destination in Pinellas County, or maybe in Tampa Bay. And they write that there's been something like 10 million visitors since it opened. I suspect that was in 82. It's an art museum.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at its core, the Dolly Museum is cool as all get out, and the innovation stuff's incredible, which we are going to talk about here. But how can an art museum be the number one? Is it that cool? You know, do they come to see Jan's building? Opened in 2011, folks. Moved out of the warehouse. They were jumping time.
There you go.
You ever stop to wonder? I mean, it's a great art museum, but still, it's not Walt Disney World.
Well, sometimes when you're there, it feels like it. You know, I mean, that's the crazy part.
It's, good answer.
I mean, Peter. The building is beautiful, and the building is definitely a main hook. But I think the collection just invites these experiences that people don't expect. So a lot of our visitors are not museum visitors. They are people who are just there for a holiday, and they were told to visit. And I would swear that so many of our visitors leave feeling really satisfied and pumped. You know, they just had experience they didn't expect, and they were totally, you know, mesmerized by it.
Well, one of the things that I've always appreciated as a sort of a sidewalk connoisseur of such things is that it changes. It's not just sort of we've had the Morse's stuff up here for years and years. You take things out of the archives, which is something we're about to talk about.
Yeah.
You have visiting exhibitions come in, things that are related to surrealism and to what Dali's works are. In other words, it's very vibrant. It's not just, well, we went there 5 years ago and nothing's changed. It always changes.
Yeah, it really does. We just put up a suite of tarot images that Dali designed. You know, we've never shown those before.
Cards, tarot cards?
Actually, they're prints, but they were done for a tarot deck that Dali eventually published in 78.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've never seen them up on the wall, and they look beautiful and strange, and it's fun. So it's true. There's definitely change happening, which gives you a reason to come back.
Beautiful and strange. I think that you should carve that on a wall.
I've heard that phrase before. Yes.
May 2nd, you opened an exhibition called The Architecture of the Dali, which talks about the old building, I suppose, and the new building, the 2011 building that Jan Weymouth designed. Absolutely gorgeous, weird, and fantastic. Has this big dome in the back now, folks, but, you know, that's cool, too. Tell me about the architecture of the Dali. I mean, is it incredibly focused on the $65 million expansion that's coming? This is what we're going to do, or is it sort of more of a history view?
Yeah, I'd say that the expansion is beautifully presented in a kind of video imagining drive ride through, so to speak, or walk through. So it's about a 3.5 minute loop where you can see on a full wall what's being projected and being, you know, explored. You walk into the room, you're on the blueprint of our current building with the new building next to it. So it's very dramatic. We have the two models, one for Jan's version of the 2011 building and one for Trevor Lamphere and Beck's new proposal. And then in the adjacent room, there's a lot of material, both archival articles and newspapers and photographs of the Morses in Cleveland, and then the museum on 3rd Street, and then our opening here in 2011. So it's a little bit of everything, but it's, you know, there's video, there's 3D models, there's articles, there's even a lot of ephemera, you know, like the ostrich egg that was given to sponsors when we broke ground for the 2010, when we we're breaking ground for the current museum.
I wasn't here. I can't even remember where I was living that particular year. It might have been Savannah, but the ostrich egg.
Yeah. We had Dali has a film back in, I guess, 73, where he and Gala are born out of an egg. They crack open this egg, and he talks about you need a little fish to understand Dali and whatever. So it's this rebirth idea that he has eggs throughout his career. So we gave ostrich eggs.
Wait. He uses egg motifs?
Egg motifs. Okay, I mean, throughout his career.
He has eggs throughout his career.
Yeah. There are eggs on his museum in Spain, eggs on the ballot. Our director, Hank Hine, just thought, wouldn't it be great to get some ostrich eggs and engrave Dali mustaches on them and give them to the sponsors?
You've got one of those?
Yes. So I'm really pleased that that's there, and that was James Martin who gave it on loan to us.
Now, as you say, the Beck Group is in charge of this expansion, which is coming, 2028, I think you're talking about?
I think
Can you give, like, the brief description of what's coming? And I know we'll have Dr. Hine in here at some point to really go into it as it approaches more clearly. But tell us about it.
Yeah, so we have our current museum, which has the two galleries, the James Gallery and the Huth Gallery, and we show our permanent collection. But what we've really, since the pandemic, we have had no opportunity to bring in groups for rentals or big, you know, parties. And more importantly, we really haven't had any kind of adequate space to bring in school groups or do educational-focused activities. We just have one small room that we share with everybody. So the idea for the expansion is to create a large hall that can also be a gallery, but then also
We're not calling it a ballroom.
We are not.
Not an East Wing ballroom.
It is going to be an exhibition.
Just wanted to interject
Yes. But it will have a you know, beautiful dining space, which we are very excited about.
Understood.
But more importantly, we've got this large room that's going to be on the bottom floor that can be go from three rooms to one very, very large room where we can have now school groups coming in busloads that can be there simultaneously doing activities and hearing things before they go in the gallery. And we can manage groups in a much more direct way that we just can't do that now.
There was talk, I remember about from Hank about, you know, the technology that's coming and how that was so important to him, interpreting Dali, if you will.
Right.
And surrealism. I mean, is there more of that coming?
Yeah, for sure. So this large gallery space that's going to be adjacent to the James Gallery will be focused on digital activities. So Hank will be able to address that because it keeps changing as we go forward.
Okay.
But yeah, but we've done a lot of AI and AR experiments over the past 10 years that have really become a key part of the way that we share Dali. So this new gallery will give us a much more exciting and dynamic way to present those kind of ideas.
And there's something that I'm sure Hank talked with me about or talked to some reporter about or maybe talked to all of us about, which is the fact that you couldn't do this with some of the AI stuff and the various things that you do digitally with Dali and surrealism in the artwork. You couldn't do it, say, with Rembrandt or somebody. It doesn't work. With Dali, it almost makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, because as John Lennon once pithily observed, nothing is real, you know, and
that's very apt.
Had to slip that in there, yeah. Peter.
Well, you know, it's like there are two things that always come to mind. In the 70s, Dali was super excited about Dr. Dennis Gabor, who was the inventor of holograms. Mm-hmm. And eventually Dali worked on holograms even with Alice Cooper. And then he also did a series of Objects and Imaginations of the Future. It was a print suite, but one of them was like what was it called? Cryonic stereo-optic computer glasses that you were to wear to see the world differently. Mm. I mean, he was constantly open to those sorts of ideas.
And he was, what, in his 70s, 80s?
Yeah. I mean, he was excited by cybernetics. He was excited by processes used by American companies to process information. He was totally plugged into that. He just was too early for it all. You know,
ahead of his time. Well, and this is the perfect thing, and I really look forward to talking about that more as time goes on. Opening this Saturday, which is May the 9th, is Dali in America. And does this just sort of start with the Morses and talk about everything that we've just
amazingly,
talked about?
It doesn't. The Morses are sort of part of the story of our building, but the focus here is clearly this idea of America as a concept. You know, Dali, Dali's discovery of America is the last painting in there, and Columbus discovering America is the story of Dali discovering America. I think he was so ready to leave Paris and find whatever he saw from the Hollywood movies. You know, he loved the Marx Brothers. He loved just the whole feel of America's exuberance. And he discovered that, you know, many fold over when he arrived in New York in 34. And so the show uses magazines, articles, videos, film to really show how not only he embraced the American experience, but the American experience turned Dali into the celebrity that we know.
Which is what we were talking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Does it follow? I mean, was he a resident of America when he passed away, or was he still in Europe somewhere?
He was in Europe at that time, and probably the last decade of his life, he didn't travel. He was in very ill state. But up until the late 70s, he would come to America, really every spring.
Oh, sure. There are photos of him with, say, Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
I've seen.
Yeah. Every year he was a resident in New York. And in the 40s, he was a resident in New York and Pebble Beach, California, every year.
Wow.
In the 40s, there were 2 years he just lived in Pebble Beach. It's like astounding.
Because, America loves an eccentric.
Yes. You know, and for him, it was like it reminded him of Spain, of his Mediterranean home. So
how did America – I remember the stuff that he did with Disney, and it's just fantastic. But how did, like, American culture, like – what did that do to his work when he went back to Europe and was painting?
Well, I think that the big change was he started to think more, what would be the right word, more brand-wise, so that some of the paintings simplified, some of the dreams became more understandable. I always think of a painting like Well, the very first one, the Surrealist poster, mm-hmm. you know, where he has a series of symbols that are associated with his name, and that's how he sells himself to the American public. And then by the time you get to a painting like Geopolitica's Child, he has simplified a lot of the ideas to where others without a background in Freud can kind of recognize the type of symbols and the ideas that he has and can really connect with them. And I think that he just found that his ability to embrace Hollywood allowed his paintings to also be more singular. So even like the later paintings, like the Crucifixion, mm-hmm. is very singular. It's monumental. It's iconic. Very different than Surrealism, where he populated his work with many images, and there was a lot of both distraction and synergy. And I think it's like a Hollywood poster seems to be the type of idea that he really resonated with him.
You have docents to do tours. Do you do tours as well? Usually when I'm there, it's an exhibition opening, and you're right. telling us all about yeah. the work. But you speak about it so eloquently, and obviously you're very knowledgeable about Dali and his processes and where he went and his influences. Is that something that you do for the public at all? I want people to hear yeah, you talk yeah. about it.
Well, I'm really happy to say that we have some exceptional docents I get uh-huh. to work with and train. But I'm going to be talking next month for our Coffee with a Curator about the Dali in America show.
In June or in May?
In June. So okay. the first Wednesday in June, 10:30 in the morning.
Is the coffee free?
The coffee's free. Well, you can't drink free coffee. The talk is free. But we do have an exceptional cafe that will be happy to provide.
I love the coffee and cafe gala. I really yeah. do. So, yeah. Peter Tosh, what a pleasure to talk to you. Anything else you want to cover that we may have missed?
I've just got to say, the show is from our permanent collection. There's about 50 objects in the Dali in America show.
Yeah.
I'm excited. It's a beautiful, crazy, over-the-top show. Everything you think about America and you think about Dali brought together in this kind of exuberant stew that I think everybody that comes is going to enjoy.
Well, that's Dali in America, and it opens this Saturday, May the 9th at the Dali Museum, the Salvador Dali Museum. I never know how I should spell it all out. I always put the little accent on it.
Yeah. Like,
you know,
nice.
I try to remember to do it. And of course, you want to get a look at the big expansion that's coming. The architecture of the Dali opened May 2nd, and they are running concurrently for a while.
They are.
Yeah.
Architecture is going to go a full year into April, and I believe that the Dali in America closes October 13th, I think.
Well, that's a way off. It's 2028, right? Have you broken ground or anything for this place?
No, yet? No. No. So we're anticipating that coming very soon.
You got a lot of the money, maybe not all of the money yet.
I'll let Hank talk about that, my
we'll
boss.
We'll do that. Yeah. We'll do that. I totally understand. Peter, thank you so much for coming in. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Bill. I really enjoyed it.